From KCRW in Los Angeles and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 year later.
1 year later.
Can you believe it's 1 year later?
1 year later.
1 year later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Jamil Smith, one of your hosts with a special series, 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. President Trump's first year in office has impacted Americans well beyond policy. He's in every story and everything, it seems. On our final show, we'll look at how he and Republicans have even politicized Christmas. Also, since I'd argue that race matters in every arena, we'll discuss African-American holiday traditions, including my interview with a Black Santa here in Los Angeles. That's coming up on 1 year later, after headlines from NPR.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
We're back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jamil Smith, contributing opinion writer with the Los Angeles Times. Now, President Trump has been saying repeatedly since 2015 that he's going to make Christmas great again, as if the holiday had been under attack. He promised that he was going to restore saying Merry Christmas, as if we hadn't been saying it. This is him talking about Christmas again and again.
You know what I'm going to say to start off? Merry Christmas.
They don't use the word Christmas because it's not politically correct. You go to the department stores and you see Happy New Year and you see red and you see snow and you see all these things. You don't see Merry Christmas anymore.
It says Happy Holidays all over. I say, where's Christmas?
With Trump as your president, we are going to be celebrating Merry Christmas again.
Thank you, President Trump, for letting us say Merry Christmas again.
Let's back up. To learn how this so-called war on Christmas got going, I'm joined by Dan Cassino, professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University. Welcome to the program, Dan.
My pleasure.
Dan, take us back to 2005 and tell us how this so-called war on Christmas got started.
It's fantastic because the war on Christmas is one of these few issues where we know exactly where it started. In 2005, in December, there was a Fox News contributor by the name of John Gibson who wrote a book about the war on Christmas, and he went on a couple different Fox News shows, most notably Bill O'Reilly, to sell his book, to move units. He talked about the war on Christmas. The segment wound up being fantastically popular for Bill O'Reilly, and O'Reilly brought back that segment three or four times in that year and then started talking about it somewhere up to 20 times a year from 2005 up until about 2010. Gibson's argument was that all the war on Christmas was about secularization. It was linked pretty closely with the movement against prayer in school, and that by taking Christmas out of the public sphere, this was the first step. They call it the wedge, the point of the spear that was going to bring in all these other liberal secular ideas. Once you get Christmas out, they argued, you would bring in euthanasia, abortion on demand, and legalized marijuana into the schools and into society in general.
When I was growing up, happy holidays usually meant, you know, Merry Christmas and Happy New Year all in one convenient phrase. How did it get twisted into this?
Well, this is really very much in what President Trump has been talking about, but also what Fox News has been talking about for a long time. The idea that the real victims in our society today are white male Christians. Now, you and I may think that white male Christians tend to still run everything in society, but there's this belief that white male Christians are the real victims, that movements towards equality and towards being nice or sympathetic to other faiths and other cultures disadvantage white male Christians. They're the real victims here. So in the past, if you had said Merry Christmas, well, no one would have gotten upset about that. And so now if I'm supposed to say Happy Holidays, boy, that means I'm a victim. I'm having to accommodate all these people. In the past, I didn't have to worry about this at all. And so this belief that they are victims, and this is a sign of that victimization. We should note this isn't even just an American phenomenon. If we were in Northern Europe, we'd be having the same conversation about a very racist character called Black Pete that they drag out for the holidays.
Indeed.
So this is a widespread thing in Western societies.
This victimization, I want to go a little bit deeper into that. Mm-hmm. What exactly does it do for Republicans? How do they benefit tangibly from that spread of that mindset?
Well, the argument here is that you need to push back against all of these things that are benefiting racial minorities, benefiting women, benefiting people from other religious groups, that it's good to push back against that because it's not neutral. Helping other people and being considerate in this view isn't something that's good for society or just generally good for everyone. It's, in fact, discrimination against white Christian men. In most recent year, in 2016, last time we asked white men if they were being discriminated against. About 40% of white Republicans say they're discriminated against on the basis of their race. About 35% say they're discriminated against on the basis of their gender. These people really believe that their gender and their race is leading to discrimination, and they're looking for any evidence of that.
I remember Megyn Kelly back in 2013 criticizing Aisha Harris, a writer for Slate, for merely writing that Santa doesn't have to be white. So this extends beyond actual, you know, gospel, which or scripture. This extends to all symbols of Christmas. What was your take on the impact of that conversation and just maybe just how it exposed for a lot of us how ridiculous this all was?
Yeah, my wife is actually from Turkey, so she immediately told me, well, wait, Santa Claus is Turkish. We all know that, St. Nicholas.
Right.
But this the symbols of Christmas have become so associated with whiteness in a very particular way of celebrating that's hard to disentangle them. And it's I think it betrays a great deal of lack of understanding of where these symbols actually come from. I mean, Mrs. Claus, for instance, is very much a suffragette symbol who comes in the 20s. I mean, it's the idea that Christmas as we have it or as we had it in the 1950s, 1960s, that is the only way Christmas should be celebrated is part and parcel of this belief that white men are being victimized, that the society is turning against them. There's no reason that Santa Claus has to be white or Mrs. Claus has to be white or Santa Claus can't be homosexual. You can make Santa Claus whatever you want. He's there to serve a purpose. But I think that's what's going on here. Santa Claus is there to serve a social purpose. So for this group, Santa Claus is representative of the way Christmas was celebrated in some imagined past. And they're going to cling to that because that's the social purpose he's serving for them at this time.
I want to introduce another guest. Brandon McGinley is a writer and editor in Pittsburgh. And in addition to his work with the Catholic media in the United States, he is a regular contributor to the Scottish Catholic Observer. Welcome to One Year Later, Brandon.
Thank you so much for having me, Jamil.
So, Brandon, Trump probably picked up some, if not all of this, from fellow Republicans and, you know, as Dan was mentioning, Fox News. But you wrote a column for The Washington Post about this that I found fascinating. How has the president essentially weaponized the phrase Merry Christmas?
Yeah, I think this is a kind of perfect example of the president trying to pantomime the most aggressive elements of a Christian politics. We know that this is not a president who really particularly cares about the Christian faith, except in as much as it can be useful to him politically. And I think the Merry Christmas phenomenon really exemplifies that. Because, as you were saying, this whole idea of a war on Christmas, this whole idea of there being some sort of almost identity politics, you know, element to saying Happy Holidays versus Merry Christmas, this is all ginned up over the past decade or so. And so for the president, he is trying to take advantage of this, I think, and turn what should be just a regular holiday greeting. And if you say Merry Christmas, fine. You say Happy Holidays, fine, whatever, as long as you're sincere about it and, you know, it's part of the cheer of the holidays, he's weaponizing it into a statement. Mm-hmm. When I say Merry Christmas, I'm making a political statement about the way I think society ought to be. And I think that it actually makes, as a Christian myself, as you mentioned, you know, I do writing for Catholic media and so on and so forth. It actually makes Christian political witness weaker. It doesn't make it stronger by asserting it this way. It actually makes what should be a really substantive, life-changing commitment to the way society should be, and it turns it into this very weak and kind of pathetic attempt to assert Christian identity through kind of turning Merry Christmas into an affront.
Yeah, Dan, President Obama said Merry Christmas all the time. I mean, MSNBC's Chris Hayes recently ran a montage of dozens of instances. And yet this myth persists that he somehow forbade Americans to say it. How does that element of it play into this?
Well, that's motivated reasoning, right? People are going to believe what fits their worldview best. They believe that Barack Obama, despite being probably more of a Christian, going to church a great deal more than President Trump ever does, that he was not a real Christian. But that's because his identity, that he was representing the sort of liberalism, the sort of accommodation they see with the rest of the world and with changes in society. That's what this is about. It's not about saying Merry Christmas. It's about accommodating people, accommodating diversity in a way that you didn't have to a long time ago. When you say make America great again, you're talking about going back to a time when white men didn't have to worry about what anyone else thought and could do whatever they wanted. And Barack Obama wasn't part of that. Barack Obama was a real threat to that, which is, I think, Donald Trump has a lot of the backlash against Barack Obama. And so you have to say, you have to believe that Barack Obama didn't let you say Merry Christmas because he wanted you to accommodate everyone else. And that's what Barack Obama represents. And that's why people, I think, are so angry at Barack Obama to this day.
Brandon McGinley, I want to ask you, what is the role of the evangelical right in furthering this false narrative?
Yeah, that's a big question. I think that what we see with a lot of this, and this goes to the questions of race that we've been discussing, and it also goes to the Merry Christmas thing. I think there's a sense in which American Christian identity is very much tied up with Americanness. And so there's kind of an Americanized Christianity. And you see this even among Catholics as well, but certainly the evangelical right in this country very much defines itself as an American type of Christianity. And so it's very difficult, if not impossible, to disentangle that kind of intentional Americanness from questions of race. And so we're talking about Black Santa, this idea that Christmas is by its very nature expressed or represented with white figures. In this country, our nativity scenes, in the nativity scene in my own home, are white people. Even though, of course, the 2,000 year ago Palestinian Arab, but I don't even know exactly what it would be.
They probably weren't white blonde Americans. They probably
exactly.
weren't blonde and blue
exactly.
eyed.
Yeah.
So, Dan Cassino, how are Democrats hitting back on this? And it's tempting to, you know, stay above this, and it's tempting also to be drawn into the pettiness of this. Are they staying above the fray, or are they getting mixed up in it?
There's certainly some evidence of them getting mixed up on it. Once you turn Santa Claus and once you turn Merry Christmas into a political symbol, both sides are going to use it. So this year there was a bit of a furor over a publication of a book called Santa's Husband, in which the only Santa Claus is an African-American man and his husband is the white guy. These are used as symbols. So not, it's not just saying Merry Christmas is a political statement. Saying Happy Holidays is a political statement where I am expressing my political beliefs. And this gets back to what Brandon was saying, that it makes it harder for me to have a conversation with someone because regardless of what I say, Happy Holidays or Merry Christmas, I've made a political statement. And honestly, if I'm just talking to my neighbors, I don't want to make a political statement. But it's almost unavoidable now. Whatever I say is going to be political. And yes, there is an element on the left of people who care very deeply and say, no, we should say Happy Holidays. But that's a reaction. They didn't start this. In fact, there's a big enthusiasm gap in the polling, such that people who believe we should say Merry Christmas and just Merry Christmas feel very deeply about it. And the people who say we should say Happy Holidays don't really seem to care that much.
Now, I'm sure that there are both atheists and people of faith alike listening to this and saying, why does any of this even matter? Brandon, what would you tell them?
It's some ways quite frustrating that in this time when so many things are going on in the world and in this country, this is what we're talking about. But I think, you know, for me as a Christian, and I know we're also trying to speak to atheists, but I think this has relevance beyond just Christianity. This really denudes the ability of Christians to participate in society, in politics as Christians and not just as political pawns. And I think that's worse for everybody. I think it's better for everybody, even atheists, even other non-believers, people of different faith backgrounds. I think it's better for everybody whenever people are participating in politics and in society in the fullness of what they believe, bringing the fullness of what they believe to the public square. And when it becomes just an identity to marshal against other people's identities, when it becomes just a when the language of the holidays, when the language of the incarnation of God in Jesus Christ becomes not just a political statement, but a partisan statement.
Mm-hmm.
That I think is worse. That I think is worse for everybody. It denudes not just for Christians, but for everybody what politics really is. It's working towards the common good.
We've been discussing the whiteness of Christmas symbols, the most prominent one being Santa Claus. Let's hear more about it from one of our listeners.
My name is Aaron Leonard. I'm 28 years old from Ladera Heights, California. I'm a young black man. My mom grew up raising us with the black Santa. So, you know, she wanted her kids to grow up knowing that Santa could be any color. So she always got shoe polish out every year and would touch it up and make sure that Santa was, you know, looked like us. And I remember growing up and going to school, you know, back then my school was predominantly white and we're the minority. So everyone else's Santa was white, and I remember making my Santa, you know, brown like the one I had at home. And my teacher, I think it was in second or third grade, my teacher came up to me and handed me another paper and said, "Oh no, honey, you did that wrong here. Start over again," you know, implying that Santa couldn't be brown. And I remember thinking, you know, at a young age, like, I wasn't discouraged or sad or anything. I was just confused because it's like my mom was always right to me. And she taught me that Santa could be, you know, my Santa was black and his Santa could be white and his Santa was Asian or Mexican. And what I learned from that was that Santa was magical, and, you know, whatever household he visited, he took on who that family was. And it was just growing up back then, being seen that brown was the wrong thing kind of deal. And I'm glad my mom raised us like that and wasn't one of those closed-minded parents, because it really helped us as a child.
Aaron's mom had to use shoe polish on their Santa decorations, but after the break, we're going to go to a magical place where we get to meet a real black Santa, South Los Angeles. Stay with us. And remember that all of our episodes are available as a podcast, too. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your audio on demand. This is 1 year later from KCRW. I'm Jamil Smith, and we're back with 1 year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center.
Santa?
Yesterday,
Santa?
I went to the Baldwin Hills Crenshaw Mall in Los Angeles.
Hello.
This time of year, there are Santas everywhere, but most of the people I met were not from the neighborhood.
My name's Ariana, and this is my one-year-old daughter, Zaya Lee. This will be her second Christmas.
Second Christmas, yes, second okay. Christmas. So how far did you travel to get here?
All the way from Orange County, over there by like Disneyland area, only because there's not too many options of different racial Santa Claus. And my daughter, she is a mixture of a lot of different races, so I want her to be able to see different like Santa Claus, so she can understand that there is different cultures out there, except just, you know, a white Santa. So
right.
I've been looking for a black Santa for a while, and this is the year that we found it. So we travel all the way from Orange County just so she could take a picture with him.
Black Santa seem hard to find now, but when Langston Patterson started serving as the Crenshaw Mall Santa 15 years ago, some say there weren't any in any American mall. In my interview with him, he told me how he got his start.
You know, I was sitting down at the table having a lunch. I had just lost my friend. And the guy walks up and he says, how would you like a job doing Santa Claus? I said, what? He said, yeah. I said, I started to say no. And then I said, oh, that sounds interesting. And I've been doing that ever since.
So tell me a little bit of what you get out of it every day.
You know, my family is all grown and live out of state. And I get a lot of enjoyment from it. This is like my Christmas.
So we see so many young babies, you know, the people coming in from all over the place.
Right.
to be taking a picture with a black Santa. Why do you think that's important?
Well, it just shows the kids that black can be Santa Claus too. That's what it shows the children. Like, I had a lady that was had a class, and she came and took a picture. She said, I had to show my class that Santa Claus can be black too, you know? So I said, fine, no problem. So, you know, I know when I grew up, Santa was white, rosy cheek, jelly belly, you know, and that was fine, you know, but this is interesting. And some people don't like it.
Do you ever have people come up to the mall and they tell you that they don't like it, or they?
No, they don't say it like that. They'll come around and say, oh, Santa Claus is white. You know, the kids will say, you're not real. I say, oh, I'm not. Touch me. Am I real?
I'm just thinking about when I was a kid, you know, there were certainly no black Santas. You didn't even see him depicted in books or in drawings,
right,
cartoons as
right,
black.
Right.
Just seeing the smiles on the kids' faces in this line.
Oh, yeah.
It's meaningful. It really is.
It is very meaningful. I know when I came up, my dad used to, I think he saw that picture, It's a Wonderful Life, I think it is. And Christmas come, of course, all the presents were in the closet, and we'd have already seen them anyway. So he would come out 5 o'clock in the morning, ho, 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 and disappear. But we didn't know that. So that's how I enjoyed mine, my mother.
You had Black Santa at home growing up, in a way.
Yeah, my dad, yeah.
I got to ask you, you know, everybody coming up to you telling you what they want for Christmas. What do you want for Christmas?
Just to be happy.
Thanks again to Santa Langston, who took some time off his Santa duties to talk to us. We're still joined by Dan Cassino, professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University, and Brandon McGinley, who writes for Catholic Publication and most recently for The Washington Post. But I want to bring on one more guest into this conversation. Lawrence Ware is the co-director of the Africana Studies program at Oklahoma State University and a contributing writer to Slate Magazine, The New York Times, and The Root. Welcome to One Year Later, Lawrence.
Good to be here.
All right. Do you have Black Santas in Oklahoma, Lawrence?
I have not been able to find a Black Santa in Oklahoma. I guess, you know, I'm the Black Santa for my house. So I guess we technically do. But no, as far as being able to go and visit one, no, I don't think we have one.
What did you think when you heard Santa Langston and some of the people in that line?
Man, I wish that I had had access to that when I was a kid. Because for me, representation matters a great deal. And so I always wonder, my mother, growing up, she collects Christmas figurines, and so she would collect a number of different kinds of Black Santas. So there would be the traditional, you know, like Black Santa, then there would be like an African clothes Black Santa. She would just have these all over the house. And I always wish that I could meet someone who would be Black and yet still be Santa. As a kid, that would have been a game changer for me, but I have all these uncomfortable pictures of me sitting on the lap of a white dude crying. So, you know, that would have been wonderful for me growing up.
You recently wrote a piece about Donny Hathaway, the gospel singer, and his classic rendition of This Christmas. Tell me what you discovered there.
Well, one of the things that I did, and I do not advise anyone to do what I did, but I listened to different renditions of This Christmas for about 48 hours. I listened to them nonstop. Drove me and my family crazy doing so. And I discovered that Donny Hathaway's is the best, as you know, I'm sure we all know. Although there are some pretty good ones out there. I think Chris Brown's is greatly overrated. But Donny Hathaway's remains the best. But also what I discovered is that this song, written by Donny Hathaway back in the 1970s, as kind of the anthem for a Black Christmas song, it just really resonates with so many different people. Lady Antebellum did a cover. Aretha Franklin, of course, did a cover that was not a great cover. Pentatonix did a cover. So many different individuals have done covers of this song. And so for some reason, that song really, really resonates with so many people. But it still remains, for me, the quintessential Black Christmas song.
You also wrote a piece about the top 10 blackest holiday TV shows and movies. Why do you care about Christmas so much?
Well, I have a son. My middle son's name is Quinn, and he's 7. And he's big into Christmas, man. He loves Christmas, and so I mean, I would catch him in July watching How the Grinch Stole Christmas. I would catch him in June trying to sneak and watch The Polar Express. And so he really, really loves Christmas. And so when Christmas comes around, I have no choice but to just, you know, be inundated with all these Christmas-themed television shows and movies and whatnot. And so one of the things that I noticed while watching all these things is, of course, I enjoy spending time with him. And I like Christmas, too. I love Christmas. You know, you might catch me on November the 1st starting to play Christmas songs.
I was going to say, it's not just Quinn, is it?
It's not just him. He gets it from somewhere, and he might get it from me. But one of the things that I noticed is that he's watching all these things, and I'm watching them with him, and we're watching things like It's a Wonderful Life, and we're watching Elf, and we're watching Home Alone. And one thing is kind of coming up to me. You know, we're watching National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, and there's no black people. Like, there's almost no black people. And if they are there, they're in the background or they're friends of the main character, right? And mm-hmm. So I begin to think, I'm like, well, do we have black Christmas movies? And, of course, I did some research, and I found This Christmas and Almost Christmas and Preacher's Wife and all these other kind of things. But when you look at what our culture consumes as the official Christmas themed movies and television specials, what you're going to find is over and over and over again white people, right? So, you know, the Hallmark Channel, for example, has created kind of an entire genre of film of white people in small towns wearing sweaters, falling in love in front of Christmas trees, and learning the true meaning of Christmas, right, with nary a black face to be found. And so I begin to think really hard about, well, what can I do? Because I'm very concerned about my son seeing himself in the things that he consumes. So I guide him towards black superheroes, and I guide him towards you know, other things that represent him. And so I begin to think really hard about, well, what can I do to help other black parents find things that represent their children in the things that they're consuming? And so I put together this thing to help people have a very black but also Merry Christmas.
Okay, I have to know, what is the top blackest holiday TV show or movie?
Well, okay, as far as movies concerned, for me, it's Preacher's Wife, because even though it's directed by Penny Marshall, which is a white female director, I mean, you got Denzel in there, you know, you got Whitney Houston in there. You know, Preacher's Wife is it. That is the movie for me. There's a little-known television special that's on Amazon Prime that many people don't know about, but for me, I love it, and my son Quinn loves it. It's called Snowy Day. It goes off of the old book, a cardboard book that we all used to read when we were younger. But it kind of modernizes it, and it's produced by Lawrence Fisher, and has Regina King on there. It has Boys to Men singing the song. It's a beautiful song. I really, really love Snowy Day. But the traditional one is probably going to be that Fat Albert's Christmas special from 1977. Even though I have uncomfortable feelings about Cosby, that Fat Albert Christmas special is kind of a go-to for most black families.
I'm going back to Dan Cassino, professor of political science at Fairleigh Dickinson University. Dan, when Donald Trump is saying Merry Christmas, of course, it seems like we talked about, he's only saying it to some, you know, some people. He's only saying it maybe to white evangelicals or maybe to his base. Do you see any other, you know, Republicans maybe trying to do something different? Do you see anywhere that Republicans trying to buck away from this war on Christmas?
Well, so there is actually a strong civil libertarian element within the Republican Party. So if you look at the libertarian side of the Republican Party, they're the ones who have been pushing back against. So the war on Christmas narrative is very much linked to the idea that prayer should be back in school, that we should bring religion back into the public sphere. And there is a libertarian side of the Republican Party that's saying, no, we should keep the government out of this completely. And really, we should be keeping religion out and keeping it out of the schools, out of the public square as much as possible. It's a minority in the Republican Party. It has been since Richard Nixon and the Southern Strategy in 1968. But I think it's also clear that Donald Trump is talking to a very specific group. He's talking to evangelicals. He doesn't have a lot to sell evangelicals. And the war on Christmas is something you can do. And it's costless. I mean, it's not like he can pass a law mandating right. Everyone say Merry Christmas. So it's costless. He can say, boy, look, I'm on your side. And it's not like an issue like abortion. We'd actually have to do something about it. Simply saying it is enough to get the victory.
Brandon, beyond Christmas, how segregated are Christian institutions in the United States?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, I mean, A lot of it depends on where you are. I grew up and still live in a city that is very white and very de facto segregated by race. And so in as much as certainly in my church, in the Catholic Church, the parishes are defined by geographic boundaries, you end up with a lot of de facto segregation because of that. And then, of course, in Protestant communities, you have the whole idea of black Protestant entire denominations that are essentially African-American denominations. And so while certainly in both Protestant communities and Catholic communities, there are some parishes and congregations that are very racially diverse, a lot of that depends on what the geography of the surrounding community is like. And sometimes even in diverse communities at worship, folks then kind of divide into separate congregations. So especially if you're already in a place that is largely white, it becomes very easy to associate your faith, whether it's a small part of your life or a big part of your life, with white people, with whiteness. And so in Catholic communities, for instance, if you're in most Catholic churches in this country, certainly a suburban Catholic church that's largely white, you're not going to find any non-white representations of certainly of Jesus or of the Holy Family, or even of saints. The Catholic Church has a wonderful tradition of non-white saints. And if you grew up in a great deal of suburban, and sometimes not even suburban, just urban or certainly rural Catholic communities, you would have no idea, unless you were actively looking it up online or something. If what you learn about the saints is what you learn in church, you're not going to find any non-white saints. And so it's easy to think that you're church, and the word Catholic means universal. It's supposed to be a universal church. It's easy to think that it's almost coextensive with whiteness.
Lawrence, I know that you wrote back in July about why you left the Southern Baptist Convention, related potentially to these reasons. Can you explain to those who haven't read it exactly why you did that?
Yeah, back in was that July? Man, it's been a long time. Yeah,
yes, it has.
July. I was really frustrated and really done with the way that the Southern Baptist Convention had, both in their policy and in the people who they put into positions of power, had center whiteness. And so they were very unwilling to decry white supremacy and to call it out. And then beyond that, they were also unwilling initially to eschew the alt-right. They didn't want to do that. And so it was put up for a vote, and then there were a number of individuals who kind of said, well, why do we even have to talk about this? And then another group of individuals pushed it off and said, we want to deal with this tomorrow or later on or just not at all. And then after all this outcry, they then came with a softer adoption, saying that we are, that white supremacy is evil and that the alt-right is wrong and things of that nature. But nevertheless, they didn't do it initially, and they did it after changing some language. And so when I saw that, and then in light of the very long history of white supremacy in the Southern Baptist Convention, going all the way back to slavery as well as through the Civil Rights era, and just being on the wrong side of history seemingly at every single step, I was just done. And so I wrote this letter in the New York Times. Well, not a letter, it's an article in the New York Times, and said I was leaving. And I wasn't expecting it to go as viral as it did, but it blew up. It was everywhere. And since then, they've made gestures, I believe, towards changing some things. But I don't think I've seen anything substantive that would make me even think about going back.
Well, love to continue this conversation, but fortunately, we're out of time. We have to leave it there. Dan Cassino, Brandon McGinley, and Lawrence Ware, thank you very much for joining us. And I'll say to you all, Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. All right. So let's think about getting, back to our pundit segment. We're going to be wrapping up this special series with our Talk It Out, our final Talk It Out segment. I'm going to bring back my co-host Jennifer Rubin and Ruben Navarrete. This is 1 year later from KCRW. I'm Jamil Smith, back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. Today is the last day of the show. It was designed as a 6-week series. And to mark the occasion, my fellow co-hosts are here. Jennifer Rubin, opinion writer and author of the Right Turn blog at The Washington Post, and Ruben Navarrete, syndicated columnist and the host of the podcast Navarrete Nation. Hello, Jennifer, and hello, Ruben.
Hi.
Hey.
All right.
Good to
talk to you. Good to talk to you, too. Wanted to first, get to the fact that this is the last show. Wow, we're here. Each of us took a different approach to hosting, of course, and we focused on issues that are a particular concern individually you know, to us in the Trump era. Now, Jennifer, one of your favorite episodes dealt with how much of a threat that the president poses to the rule of law, a key feature of our democracy. And I want to play a little bit of sound from one of your guests, Ian Bassin of Project Democracy.
If you look at the rise of autocrats around the world in the 21st century, people like Erdogan in Turkey or Putin in Russia, it took them 4, 5, 6 years in office before they started doing some of the things that we're seeing already in the first year of the Trump administration. You recall when Erdogan took over in Turkey and when Putin took over in Russia, they were seen around the world as democratic reformers. Erdogan was going to bring Turkey into the European Union. Putin was going to extend Yeltsin's democratic reforms. And it wasn't really until about 5 years in office that people started to say, uh-oh, something's not right here. What we've seen in the first year of the Trump administration is a range of behavior characteristic of autocrats around the world, from the attacks on the rule of law, the attacks on the courts, the spreading of misinformation, the Pence-Kobach Commission, which is, you know, pretty transparently designed to go out and suppress votes to corrupt elections. These are patterns that should be very disturbing in a democracy.
Jennifer, why did that show resonate with you in particular?
I think because the guests really got at the nub of the concerns that I have and a lot of the so-called never Trumpers have had from really the beginning. And that's that the president, quite aside from whatever you think of the policies, does represent a unique threat to our democracy. And in the discussion that we had, I think we really explored the extent of that, the seriousness of that, and got to, I think, a better understanding of what the challenges are going to be ahead. I will say that the show left me both more confident and optimistic, as well as more frightened. Optimistic because there are people like Ian Bassin's group and many others out there who are really taking the fight to the administration, and more concerned because I think it's so systematic and pervasive.
Ruben, on a little bit of a lighter note, you were particularly proud of your show about the film Coco and how it's come as a breath of fresh air for Latinos after being picked on by Trump for more than 2 years now. Here was journalist Daniel Hernandez on your program.
When you think about some of the stuff that children in this country who are brown in some way, who are Mexican in some way, who are Latino in some way, have been feeling over the past couple of years. You know, I was remembering during the campaign just now that in the middle of America, there were people, teens were yelling, build a wall to opposing teams
right.
with largely Hispanic
right.
High school populations at basketball games and at football games. That's very painful to hear, having been myself someone who grew up, you know, I came of age as a teenager in the 90s. Here in California, we had Pete Wilson. You know, basically comparing us to cockroaches crossing the border. That was very painful and hurtful to me as a 13 and a 14-year-old. Imagine now seeing these kinds of images, 7-year-old, 8-year-old, and then just at this moment, this film comes along where being Mexican is front and centered and is really celebrated and treated in a very nuanced and celebratory way.
Ruben, tell us more about why you wanted to talk about that film. And please, no spoilers for those of us who haven't seen it yet.
Yes, I have to give all credit to my producer on that segment, with Yael Evanor, who I think we've all worked for, and just terrific.
Indeed.
And to get into the spirit of it, she went to go see the movie on her own the day before the show aired, and you know, really picked great audio to make that show work. And I think the significance of that movie, it's made over $400 million worldwide in global box office. It speaks to Latinos and non-Latinos alike. It's very well done. It's an animated film that deals with the issue of death in a way that's very respectful and sort of captures the uniqueness of Latino culture. And it could not have been done without a really strong element of participation from Latino producers and stars and writers and directors and consultants even. So it was really well done. It's kind of a blueprint for Hollywood, how they can do right and also do very well financially all at once. So we wanted to do it. And also against the Trump background, you know, as a never Trumper and someone I ended up in the center, Jamil, because I was never Trump and in November also never Clinton. I looked at my choices on the ballot and said, what the heck is this? Like a lot of other Americans, I think. So I, as a never Trumper, really am sensitive to the fact that Donald Trump has treated Latinos as his own personal piñata ever since he came down the staircase at Trump Tower, the escalator at Trump Tower. And this is a movie was sort of an antidote to many of those negative feelings that Latinos are feeling in the Trump era.
So, yeah, no, I agree with all of that. And I just wanted to get to the bit that I had from the show that I was particularly proud of. It's an episode that centered on race and the Second Amendment in the Trump era. And as part of this series, we reached out to listeners to share their thoughts on the issues. Here is part of a very civil conversation on gun control between a Trump supporter in Colorado and a liberal voter in Florida.
While I agree that our rights are important, I also believe that there is some problem, something wrong with the way that we fail to react, fail to take action to do anything about the violence in our society, and specifically around guns.
I agree that there is something wrong in our society, absolutely. There's just crazy people out there that just go off the deep end or something and get a weapon and shoot people. And it's terrible. And I feel very, very badly for the victims of these shootings. But I don't think gun control is the answer, because it's just more government intrusion into our lives. I think the answer is love and getting back to Judeo-Christian values and punishing the criminals and not coddling them.
I generally agree with that. But what I see in the way that we actually react to these horribly common events is that we scream at each other, either take away all the guns or no, we need to put guns everywhere to make it safe.
Right.
And yeah, and it's like, wait, can't we just sit down like adults and take some real action, not some small, well, let's ban this one particular type of trigger. It's like, well, that's not going to do anything. Let's figure out what might actually make a difference. When you have a problem, you can't fix it if you don't start somewhere.
Right. Discussing the causes
of just
violence in general. Is that one?
And I mean, it would be a start. It would be a start.
Right.
I love that show and that conversation, you two, because it centers on the most important things, saving lives while protecting rights. But, you know, both are possible, of course. But two other things. I'll just say that, those kinds of conversations feel like unicorns in a political moment that's fraught with so much division and false outrage. And I want to ask you guys if, you know, what your thoughts on this were as well. But what I liked most about it in this series was the intellectual honesty of our hosts, our guests, and our listeners. Intellectual honesty and critical thinking in and about our politics. Just, I want more of that, please, in 2018 and beyond.
Amen. Well, I think that is, just to put a plug for public radio, that's what you get when you have the luxury of time. It's ironic that cable television has all the time in the world, and they manage to fill it with junk most of the time. And these little repeated sound bites and repeated stories that they do over and over again without depth and without expansion. And I do think there is a capacity for the public to try to wrestle with these issues and to try to understand these issues. My sense, and I don't know if Ruben and Jamil feel this way, people are sort of exhausted by the screaming and they're tired of being mad, and they'd either like it all to go away or all to try to lower the temperature and, as you say in this segment, talk things out.
Yes. Ruben, we got about a minute left. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely. I agree with Jennifer. We need much more honesty, much more nuance, less ascribing of motives. I think we see this on the left and the right. It's running rampant. It's not enough to disagree with somebody. You have to somehow demonize the other person. I disagree with you, therefore you're a bad person because I'm completely sure that I'm a good person. And you see it in both political parties, and we ought to see less of it. And one of the great things about this series and this show that I enjoyed doing so much was you do get the information out without necessarily ascribing motives. We had some great callers. Our listeners are very intuitive about this stuff, and they really are craving and hungering for the kind of honest discussion that you and Jennifer are talking about.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, I really want to thank you guys for coming back and helping me close this out. Thank you very much to Jennifer Rubin and Ruben Navarrete.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
That's it for 1 year later, folks. This series was produced by Sasha Woodruff, Yael Evan Orr, Sarah Fay, Gideon Bauer, and Devin Schwartz. Our managing producer is Katie Cooper, and the executive producer is Quinn O'Toole. The technical directors are Mike Newport and Joel Stein. And today's final last note, This Christmas by Donny Hathaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.